Welcome to Worlds Apart. It may sound too esoteric, but in the final analysis, we are all children of the Earth, although our access to its reaches and our exposure to its wrath differs immensely, and not only because of sheer luck. Over the past couple of centuries, the resources of this planet have been eagerly and often wastefully exploited by the so-called developed countries, leaving the rest to pick up the pieces. The toll of such an approach is broadly recognized, but why has it not materialized yet into any practical form of environmental accountability? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Harjit Singh, a climate activist and global engagement director at the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Initiative. Mr. Singh, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much, Oksana, for having me.
Let me first start with a difficult question, because I think that the issue of protecting the environment is a very complicated one. On the one hand, it's practically relevant to each and every one of us. It's the air we breathe, the water we drink, the weather we enjoy or suffer. But on the other hand, it can be very abstract, very elitist, and very political. And I know that there are concerns in many countries that politicians or whole nations may be exploiting it in a pretty manipulative way. I want to ask you personally, how do you distinguish between what's genuine and what's manipulative or self-serving in the current environmental debate?
Oksana, as you said, this is deeply political, but I would slightly differ and say it's not abstract. I think it's absolutely clear. The reason we see environmental degradation all around us is because of the choices we have made over the last few decades and centuries. It's the political economy that has driven the environmental degradation and the climate crisis, biodiversity crisis, or even the energy crisis that we are facing at this moment. So it's our economic policies that have been responsible for this polycrisis that the world is facing right now. And not only people in the developing world, but also in the developed societies, they are really struggling to make their ends meet because the money is now far more concentrated in a few hands. And when we talk about protecting the environment, we would like to see genuine efforts made by governments to put environment ecology at the center of our development paradigm. It is a false dichotomy to look at environment and development separate. They are not.
You mentioned the word political economy. We will focus on the fuel later, but I think there is a much larger question that many of our societies live within the economic system that encourages overconsumption, that encourages overproduction, and that in itself drives the need for fuel. Shouldn't that be addressed first before we switch to the particulars of which kind of fuel we are going to use?
Well, you are absolutely right on the part that the kind of development model that has been promoted, which encourages ordinary citizens to overconsume without realizing that our actions have a huge impact on the environmental ecosystem and eventually us. Look at how climate crisis is affecting everybody, including human beings.
Absolutely. And even personal health, for example.
Exactly. And the way our health systems are affected, it's the way our society is being disrupted. All that is because of the economic model that promotes overconsumption. And, you know, if there's a metric called overshoot day, which tells us that, you know, by the time we reach half of the calendar year, we start extracting more than allowing natural resources to regenerate. So that's the state of affairs. And we are already living through the sixth mass extinction. And it's all caused by human beings and our so-called developmental model.
Mr. Singh, you often talk about how rich countries don't fully appreciate that their development has come on the backs of poor countries, while at the same time promoting their models as something to emulate or portraying themselves to be climate trendsetters or climate leaders. And as frustrating as it is, history doesn't come with file a complaint or get the reimbursement options. I mean, it is what it is. Why is any discussion about the bygones, about the winners and losers of the industrial era, relevant to the present?
Oksana, you've asked a number of things. Let me try and respond by saying that the most important thing that we look at when we talk about climate action, or rather climate justice, is equity. So who is responsible for the crisis? Who has the biggest responsibility to fix it? And who is suffering? Now, that's what is justice that we talk about. And the reality is that the United States and European Union are cumulatively responsible for more than half of the greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere, which have caused the problem in the first place. There is no doubt that that balance has shifted. Now, developing countries are producing more greenhouse gases, but the reality is that we knew about climate change 50 years ago, that it's fossil fuels which are responsible, you know, the extraction and burning. Yet we promoted the same model of development. And despite having a convention in 1992, which clearly states the responsibility lies mostly with rich countries, not only to reduce their emissions, but also support developing countries to take a greener pathway, that has not happened. So developing countries have been left on their own, and the resources that they had in terms of fossil fuels, they started using those. And that's why now more emissions are coming from developing countries. But it's important to recognize it has happened because no financial support and technology was provided to them. And rich countries continue to increase their emissions and continue to promote that extractive development model. Mm-hmm.
Now, I also heard you say in another interview that the United States, which is the world's largest oil producer and historically the biggest emitter, has also done the most in order to block or undermine this initiative that aims to bring some sort of not only environmental accountability, but also environmental transition to a different model. In what way has Washington dragged its feet?
Right from the day one, when even the convention was being crafted in early 90s, the United States was very clear that it would not take any action that would affect its economy. And Senior Bush was known for saying that American lifestyle is not on the table for any kind of compromise. Now, not only they continued with their high consumption economic model, they promoted it elsewhere, and they did not allow climate negotiations to make progress. And they did not take strong targets based on their fair share, based on their historical emissions. Rather, they kept dragging their feet and kept and put the responsibility on China and India and other developing countries. Instead, what they should have done was to share resources in terms of finance and technology to help developing countries who just began industrialization 30 years ago to start using green technology right from the day one. And it has been blocking negotiations. You talk about the strong mitigation targets, the concept of adaptation. They have not provided any resources to communities and countries to now deal with climate impacts. And I have been a witness to loss and damage negotiations for the last 15 years, how they blocked it systematically. They did not want to pay a single penny, and they did not allow developing countries to even have it on the agenda. I have seen it happening, you know, in front of my eyes. So US has been the biggest blocker and has been obstructing negotiations.
Can I ask you, how do you understand this US's resistance? Is it because the Americans don't want to be bound by any international treaties, or is it perhaps because they want to continue with the same sort of modus operandi, seeing the rest of the world as their resource base and seeing themselves as entitled to, you know, the best quality of life the world can offer?
Well, this is not the first time U.S. has been abdicating its responsibility for years and decades. You talk about Child Rights Convention, you talk about human rights, you talk about anti-nuclear movement. U.S. engages to water it down, then in the end, it does not agree to that treaty or agreement and doesn't really endorse it. So that's the reality of the United States, because the whole focus of the U.S. is to continue with its hegemony, continue with its economic might, and that completely ignores all the important issues for the society and environment. So this has been a historical track record of the U.S. To not cooperate internationally, for the greater causes.
But Mr. Singh, I think there is also a major legal issue here, not only with the American society, but with many Western societies, because they have these multinational corporations that operate all around the world, that plunder often the world's resources, but they are formally separated from national governments, although they often act as emissaries of Western elites and provide or sort of push for their agenda. And I wonder, how do you envisage it, even if, let's say, the United States is shamed into cooperation, although it's very unlikely, but let's assume that's the case. How do you see it happening? Because I can imagine, let's say, a poor or middle income person in Ohio who would tell you that, he or she has nothing to do with the profits or harm that Chevron or ExxonMobil has caused somewhere. Why should that compensation come out of his own tax money?
Well, we all know that U.S. politics, or in most Western countries, it's corporations who are calling the shots, who have politicians in their pockets, and that's how policies are crafted. And, let's talk about climate data. Only 100 companies are responsible for more than 70% of cumulative emissions. That's the reality. And most of these companies are based in the Western world. They did not want their governments to take strong action. And that's why countries like the United States or European Union, to the large extent, have not taken such strong actions. So we have to, call out those companies. And there is no doubt that there are many people in the developed world who are also suffering from climate impacts. They need to be supported. But their governments are rich and they can support. I think what people need to realize, ordinary citizens in the US and European Union, that they have enjoyed the fruits of industrialization, which has happened at the cost of the global ecosystem. So there is a responsibility on the part of their governments, I'm not saying citizens, their governments, to pay for the damage, to help it repair. And this is why there is a responsibility of rich countries to support developing countries. And I must also mention that we talk about climate crisis, which is a global phenomenon. And only US taking action domestically also, it's not going to be enough. As I said earlier, if now more emissions are going to come from developing countries, it is in our interest, it is in the interest of the developed country citizens to support developing countries so that they can also adopt a greener pathway, because we all have to protect our global climate system. So it is not either or. People who are vulnerable in the developed world, they also need to be supported, but their governments are rich and can afford. Whereas people in developing countries are doubly, triply marginalized because they are not responsible. They don't have resources, and their governments also don't have resources.
Okay, well, Mr. Singh, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Y'all probably heard my little sister story, Kaylin, the model girl that had got killed. Y'all probably seen it all over the news on 7030, man. She got shot in the drive-by shooting.
My brother Terrell, he was shot and killed by helping a friend unload drugs into the church. So now I never look at churches as being a safe ground
I got shot and lost my leg. That's the outcome of it, but everything's still the same. Ain't nothing changed.
The Chicago police is the biggest gang in Chicago. It's like when you get pulled over by police, you literally think your life is over, man.
That's another crime scene. Another one lost. Oh, this could have been a doctor, a nurse, could have been the next president. But we can't keep losing our people out here.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Harjit Singh, Global Engagement Director at the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Initiative. Mr. Singh, I come from Russia, which is also a major oil-producing country. And like many petrostates, it has a somewhat hedgy position on this treaty because on the one hand, it recognizes the need to limit the negative impact on the environment and assist developing countries in acquiring more modern, more environmentally friendly technology. But on the other hand, it doesn't support, or I think even doesn't believe in the phasing out of fossil fuels completely or speedily, claiming that it's simply not feasible in some locales. What do you make of this position?
Well, science has proven there are now many reports, including the biggest authority on climate science, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, making it very clear that we need to move away from fossil fuels and we need to be investing much more in renewable energy, such as wind and solar. And it is absolutely possible. So as Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Initiative, we have also come up with several reports by well-known scientists clearly claiming that there is enough resource that can be deployed to promote renewable energy. There are some difficult sectors such as steel and cement, and there also technologies are evolving to displace the use of fossil fuels. More we keep saying that we cannot move away from fossil fuels and phase them out, more we will continue to rely on these dangerous technologies and fuels which have caused the problem in the first place.
Well, Mr. Singh, I'm frankly not fully persuaded on the wide availability of solar and wind energy coming from the north of Russia. I can tell you that we do not get much sunlight. They are sure Russia could find alternative sources, and it's been developing, let's say, peaceful nuclear energy. But again, it takes a lot of investment. It takes a lot of attention. And I'm sure you are aware of the current geopolitical tensions that surely divert budgetary resources to more pressing concerns. But that's even beyond the point. I think the Russians have warned that a speedy fossil fuel phase out would hurt not only their economy, but first and foremost, people in South Africa, in South America, rather, in Africa, in Asia Pacific, where energy sources cheaper than hydrocarbons are not readily available and that have massive populations that need access to food, transportation, energy, other public services now. And it would be immoral to ask, you know, people who are already leading compromised lives to tighten up their belts for the sake of saving the planet for future generations in rich countries somewhere, you know, on the other side of the world. What do you think about that?
Oksana, I must say that this is an absolutely wrong narrative, and I can prove it by saying that now the whole world is talking about Africa needs energy. Tell me what has happened in the last 3-4 decades to power Africa with the kind of energy it needs. 600 million people do not have access to energy. More than 1 billion people do not have access to clean cooking sources. Only 2% of renewable energy investment has gone to Africa. So now that people are discovering the fossil fuel sources in Africa, they would like to invest because the supply has been disrupted and needs are increasing. Why are we not investing in renewable energy? And especially now when we are at a point that the cost of renewable energy is cheaper than fossil fuels. it's a wrong pretext to say that fossil fuels are cheaper because we have not taken into account the externalities and the other environmental cost of fossil fuels. If we continue to ignore that, look at what we are facing at this moment. The kind of floods that we saw in Dubai are unprecedented. And there's a clear link to climate change. The human cost, the economic cost that we are paying because of our continuous use of fossil fuels are not taken into account. We have no option but to shift to renewable energy. Africa has a huge renewable energy potential. Why are we not investing money on renewable energy?
Okay, why are we not investing? Let me try to respond to that with a hypothesis as to why. I've been covering geopolitics for like two decades, and I've never seen international solidarity in a shorter supply than right now. And I think you would agree, any treaty, let alone such a far-reaching one, requires concerted effort and genuine solidarity. What makes you believe that with the current state of affairs, and you know about all the conflicts around the world and, you know, all the power struggle around the world, what makes you believe that, you know, those divides can be breached when, in fact, most of the analysts, political analysts right now are discussing a potential for the third new world war, which could destroy the world much faster than any climate change?
Well, it is an absolutely sad reality that now resources are going into wars, which are causing destruction, which are you know, taking innocent lives, and which are also taking the political attention away from what is absolutely needed to respond to the climate emergency. So, in fact, I would argue that this is the point when we need a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty much more than ever, because we have avoided a holistic conversation on fossil fuels. Let us recognize that we all say that fossil fuels are the culprit and that has caused the problem in the first place. But we also do realize and acknowledge that millions of workers are dependent on fossil fuels for their jobs. We also recognize that you cannot stop the use of fossil fuels immediately because that will cause economic and social disruption. So what do we need? We have avoided a real conversation on phasing out fossil fuels. Look at what Paris Agreement has done. Did not even mention coal, oil, or gas. You know, convention did not talk about the role of fossil fuels. So we have to talk about it. You know, the brief mention of transitioning away from fossil fuels without much details, without providing sufficient finance and technology, we will not be able to do it. Trust me, we will be meeting after 10 years, Oksana, and we will realize that we are in a far worse situation if we don't have a global framework to understand who needs support. You know, we started our conversation with equity. Who is responsible for the crisis? Who has caused it in the first place? Who needs to provide more resources? And that cannot happen unless we have a global framework in the form of a fossil fuel treaty that is going to look into all these issues. So I would say we need the treaty more than ever because we are lacking global cooperation. And that's why we need to come to the table to come up with a plan so that we can support those communities and countries.
Now, speaking about the treaty, at the last UN Climate Summit, COP28, an agreement was reached, I think you briefly referenced it, for transitioning away from fossil fuel in energy systems in a just, orderly, and equitable manner. It's not exactly the phase out that environmentalists like you perhaps wanted, but, you know, it's a step forward. But I do want to ask you specifically about these three adjectives: just, orderly, and equitable. It's pretty clear that some island nation and some you know, oil producing state would see what's just and what's equitable in pretty, you know, diverse terms, simply because their circumstances are very different. I know you've been part of many of these discussions. I wonder, how does it even look like, you know, those countries sitting together in one room and trying to coin out a compromise when their positions are so polarized?
Well, this is the biggest problem that we face at the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC, because every decision has to be agreed by everybody. And this is the reason what we get in this place is lowest common denominator, which means something which everybody can agree to. Now, how can island nations who are suffering the wrath of climate change, who are on the front line, who are seeing their territories being you know, submerged into sea and houses being swept away, to agree to a transition that's going to take, you know, now decades, knowing that fossil fuels have caused the problem? Whereas there are countries who are so heavily reliant on fossil fuels, you know, for their economy or jobs. And that there are countries, large number of countries in between who depend on fossil fuels. So that's why those three words that you mentioned, just, equitable, and orderly, are important. So we are pleased that those words were mentioned, because that's what we also have been advocating for. It has to be done in a just manner. So countries who need support, they need that kind of, you know, financial and technological support. Equitable means countries who are most responsible have to do a lot more and a lot faster and support other countries. And orderly, because we also need to make sure that, you know, people who are depending on those fossil fuel resources, and I'm particularly talking of people in developing countries or even workers in the rich world, they need support to that transition. So it has to be orderly, because we cannot afford to cause social and economic disruption. But again, rich countries have a much greater responsibility to enable that just, equitable, and orderly transition.
Now, Mr. Singh, I have time for just one question. Given that, you know, everything we discussed, how difficult it is to bring the rich countries to the table, because ultimately, I think they don't want to part ways with their own privileges and unfair competitive advantages, but given how difficult it is and they are unwilling to participate authentically, do you think this initiative stands any chance without them? Could other countries take it forward and perhaps then put reputational pressure on the West and other parts, rich parts of the world, to join in?
Well, that's exactly the route that we are taking, Oksana. You're absolutely right. As you know, the treaty initiative, this campaign, is led by countries who are most vulnerable. So the leadership came from the Pacific nations, countries like Vanuatu and Tuvalu led it, and then many nations joined. And then we also got countries like Timor-Leste and Colombia, who are dependent on fossil fuels for their economy. And that what makes it absolutely real. So vulnerable countries leading and demanding the need for the treaty. Then countries like Colombia saying, we have shown the political will. We want to move away from fossil fuels. We need a global framework. So what we want to do is to actually create and grow this coalition of willing to craft now the language of the treaty, and then force those countries who are sitting on the fence or trying to reject the idea to come on board. But again, we don't want to follow the same model that we have at UNFCCC, where everybody has to agree. Then we will never have a strong legal framework. That's what is needed. So the leadership has to come from the vulnerable countries, and you know, the rich producer countries need to join and then agree to the treaty.
And I would add to that that given geopolitical shifts in the world, it's an you know, a pretty good time for that, because many big countries like Russia and China also are, you know, trying to search for good graces of the global South and the developing world, and they may, you know, join their initiatives, you know, out of their own interest, or perhaps out of, you know, their own political reasons. But, you know, it's the way you deal with the zeitgeist, I think that's important. And I'm glad you said that it can't be done without those who are not yet willing to join. We have to leave it there, but it's been immense pleasure for me to talk to you. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.